Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this fast-paced podcast that deals with tax issues, estate planning, business planning, issues of interest, hopefully to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you'd like to subscribe to the blog Blueprint for Wealth, please sign up at www.blueprintforwealth.org. And if you'd like to visit the website and hear some podcasts, see some video, and also read some articles on tax, business, and estate planning issues of interest, please sign up for a subscription, and every time we post something, you'll get an email from us. The site is sponsored by my law firm, which is Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman. We're located in Reston, Virginia, serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about the firm, visit us at ofplaw.com. Today, I am extremely pleased to have a very special guest join us on this podcast. And my special guest is John Chapatin, who is also known as Buck Chapatin. And welcome to the podcast, Buck.
Thank you, Wayne, my pleasure.
And Buck is a partner of Brown Advisory and senior advisor in the Washington, D.C. office. He is, if you don't know tax law, then I don't know how to introduce him other than as a nationally recognized tax expert. He works closely with many of Brown Advisory's private and institutional clients, but prior to joining Brown Advisory, he was a partner of Vinson & Elkins, a Houston-based law firm whose Washington office he managed for 16 years. But more notably, he served as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Tax Policy under President Reagan, and we have a lot to talk about in terms of past tax reform efforts as well as future tax reform efforts. And his experience in tax issues obviously prepares him well for providing valuable strategic advice to private clients who face complex decisions with regard to structuring and managing their assets. And before I jump into tax reform, Buck, I'd really like to know a little bit about your background. You said you're from Galveston, you practiced law in Galveston.
No, practiced law in Houston.
In Houston.
Right.
And tell me a little bit about your background. How did you ultimately get to the Treasury from where you were?
I practiced law. I went to Texas Law School, University of Texas Law School at Austin. I loved law school. My son said, "Dad, you didn't love law school. You just remember that you loved law school." But I thought I did. And I really loved law practice. I practiced for almost 8 years with Andrews and Kurth in Houston. Great firm. And I was a little anxious. I wanted to sort of get back into the real nitty-gritty of tax law. And so I just thought about going to Treasury. And I called and said I'd like to come meet you guys. And they invited me up, and they hired me. This was in the early 70s.
So you started out at Treasury after practicing law for a while at a very young age.
Well, about 32 or 3, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what was your position there at that time?
Well, I went on the staff of the Tax Legislative Council's office in the Treasury Department.
Right.
Which is the legal staff in the tax policy, that is the tax policy office. And then there were some people above me who stepped down, and I did become the head of that office, the Tax Legislative Council. There were only 15 lawyers in the office, so it wasn't a huge office, but a very bright bunch of people. All men, of course, then. Very different now.
Right. And then you left Treasury, and where did you go from there?
I left Treasury, returned to Houston, but I did not return to Andrews & Kurth. I went to Vinson & Elkins as a partner, and I stayed with Vinson & Elkins for 8 years in the 70s. And then when Ronald Reagan was elected, I did get a call from the headhunter, the people who were filling out the department.
Transition team.
And they asked me to consider becoming Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy. And
that was a pretty heady time for tax legislation, as I recall. I mean, I started my career back in 1980, and we saw a bunch of tax bills come up before the big one in 1986.
Yeah, that's very true. It was a really fun place for me to be. I mean, it's just an incredible amount of work, and you're working with very bright guys and then women. And unlike my first tour, I was thrown in the political side. I had not been, and not that political, but I was definitely thrown because I testified so much before the tax writing committees and other committees, small business committees. Mm-hmm. But in answer to your specific question, we had three major tax bills before the 1986 Act, but the big one, Reagan came to town. When we arrived in town, the top tax rate was 70%.
Can you believe that? 70%?
Hard to believe.
In the United States, although overseas, I guess it's not unheard of.
Well, it wasn't unheard of then, but now it is. I mean, we started dropping rates, both individual and corporations, starting with Reagan. And the rest of the free world, the rest of our trading partners have followed suit. So tax rates are very low around the world now.
So we had the Economic Recovery Tax Act of 1980.
1981.
81. And tell me, I remember pretty well a lot of the provisions in there because I was preparing tax returns at Arthur Andersen at that time. But I seem to recall that there were a lot of changes that led to tax incentives and deductions and credits that otherwise never were available previously. What was going on at that point in time?
You have a keen memory. Two things happened in the 81 Act, IRTA. The first and the most prominent was we proposed a 30% cut in tax rates across the board. We achieved a 25% cut. That's what Howard Baker said was a riverboat gamble. We'll have to see how it works.
Right.
The other side of the coin, though, we dramatically increased useful lives on depreciation purposes and on top of that, reinstated the investment tax credit. The benefits were so dramatic that I remember being told late in 81 or early 82 that the generals weren't going to pay any tax at all, the generals being General Electric, General Motors, and General Dynamics. All the big companies had been made tax-free with just big write-offs. And the funny thing about it, in those days, it was equipment write-off. You know, it wasn't computer software or things like that that we live.
We didn't have computer software.
That's right.
I think I started using a PC in 1982 was the first time I saw it.
You were early then.
That's right.
The lawyers I worked with didn't.
That's right. So IRTA enacted a lot of tax incentives. Wasn't there also indexing or indexation was introduced in IRTA as well?
That's correct. Indexation of the tax rates and the personal exemption, which had not been proposed by the administration.
Oh, is that right?
But was adopted. It was proposed by the Senate Finance Committee, and we signed on to it. It's very politically popular, and it did pass.
So then we had TEFRA in 82 and DEFRA after that. What were those bills all about generally?
You know, TEFRA was taking, primarily a feature of it, was taking back some of the overly generous depreciation and write-offs. As you alluded to earlier, when you get those big incentive deductions, you really did generate a heck of a lot. It was sort of aimed at the corporate community, but it really created, spawned a huge tax shelter industry.
Right.
And the benefits.
I was
frankly,
in the middle of that.
Were you?
I was preparing private placement memoranda and writing the tax sections on all of those, 4-to-1 to 20-to-1 write-off deals, and it was amazing how much was floating out there.
Right. I mean, you couple it with debt.
Right.
And we did analysis then that the effective tax rate of debt-financed property with those write-offs was below zero.
Negative.
Negative tax rate. Stated differently, you're better off with the tax system than without the tax system. Your return increases when you add taxes. Now, you have to be able to use those tax benefits against other salary or some other income, but it's just way too generous.
And that was never intended when the legislation was enacted, right?
Well, you know, the legislation was enacted in the euphoria of the sort of the supply side
economic.
Picture. So they wanted to really reduce the tax on capital, and they achieved it. So they didn't get it with the niceties of what the effective tax rate could be, but they wanted it to be very big. And they really did not like the take back that we did in that the Congress did. I say we, I mean, we proposed and everything, but Congress enacted a reduction of the, slight reduction of the write-offs in TEFRA in 1982.
And there were a lot of changes in the retirement plan system at that point in time, I remember.
That's correct.
Ultimately, you know, President Reagan came out in his re-election campaign, and after he was re-elected in 84, he really started focusing on the tax code as being the bane of his existence. What led to the Tax Reform Act of 86? What was your recollection of the history there?
Reagan came to town wanting lower tax rates. That was his fixation. And we had the three major tax bills that we've referred to. And then in there was still a lot of dissatisfaction with the Internal Revenue Code. And rates were still high. I mean, they were 50%.
Right.
Bradley Gephardt, the Democrats proposed a tax reform bill which would have dramatically reduced tax rates and simplified the code, they said.
Mm-hmm.
And they were right. It did a lot of that. And so there was a lot of feeling in the White House that they should, that we should respond in some way. A lot of objection, too, because the point was validly made that, look, the whole first term had focused on taxes, and we put tax reform on the table. It's going to just consume the domestic policy of the administration.
Right.
But the pro-tax crowd doing something on taxes won out, and so Reagan, in his 1984 State of the Union message, said that he had directed the Treasury Department to develop tax reform proposals that would lower rates and tax rates and simplify the system and make it more fair for all taxpayers, rich and poor alike. And he told them, and he said, and I've asked him to give me the report in December of this year, which of course it was presidential election in November of that year.
Right.
In the State of the Union, the audience laughed, the Congress laughed, and he didn't really get it. You know, he was very serious about it. He said, "Did I say something funny?" If you remember that.
I do remember that.
And he had said something funny, but he hadn't intended it to be funny. But Treasury was developed tax reform proposals over that entire year under total lockdown conditions. There was never a leak in what we were doing. Including and not a leak to the White House, because the White House wanted deniability, credible deniability,
right,
if we came out with something they didn't like.
Right.
And the only change the White House made, the president made a speech at some point that we wouldn't do anything with the home mortgage deduction. Well, absent that speech, we would have definitely done limited we would have proposed eliminating, I'm sure, the home mortgage deduction. To get the rates down, and because it has an influence on the economy. The economists will tell you that it makes us overspend on unproductive assets, on housing.
Right. So you left Treasury after the report was introduced?
No, I left Treasury just before the report. Well, not just before, in August. And the report
but
was
you had been working.
Yeah, I had headed the effort. But I realized, in retrospect, it was correct. If I didn't leave, and I talked to Bob Dolan, I talked to the secretary and others about when I could leave, because I'd been there for almost 4 years, and those jobs are really tough on your family. If I'd been single, I'd probably still be there. I mean, I loved every minute of it. But and I was right. Had I not left then, I would have had to stay another 2 years, and it was too long.
Now, the Tax Reform Act of 86, I mean, a lot of us have read books on it. Showdown at Gucci Gulch, I remember a lot of the language in there about some of the people that we know in common. It was an interesting dynamic between the Senate and the House and the President and the Treasury, how mm-hmm. they ultimately came to a conclusion that resulted in a major overhaul of the tax code in 1986. Today, there seems to be rumblings, and there are a lot of people who are out there trying to seek tax reform. Representative Camp, head of the Ways and Means Committee, is doing that. Baucus was, until he announced his retirement on the Senate side. What are your thoughts about tax reform today and whether or not we can accomplish that compared to what we saw in 86? Mm-hmm. Was a very different political environment then.
You know, it is a very different political environment, and there is a lot of effort being made at tax reform. I was sort of surprised. He raised the point, Chairman Camp of the Ways and Means Committee, who is retiring, but has a very bold tax reform proposal out there, and of course Chairman Baucus had studies and proposals. And then we've all seen the Simpson-Bowles package, which is an overall debt package, but a big part of it is tax reform. And that sort of gets people ginned up to do something like it, because everybody hates the tax code. And let me say, with good reason, they hate the tax code. It is so unnecessarily complex. The rates are so unnecessarily high. And so I've been beating this bandwagon for a long time. But to repeat, and I think the experts do describe the 86 Act with its errors and give and take as really the high point, high water mark of tax policy, that it was really a good proposal. A good legislation.
Good compromise, yeah.
Good compromise. Definitely compromise, which we can't seem to do today. But and it dropped rates. The top tax rate was 28%, top individual tax rate.
Right.
The top corporate rate was dropped to 34%. But to get the problem, we just couldn't get, well, number one, you had leadership, presidential leadership. And you had Jim Baker at Treasury, was a very respected Secretary of the Treasury. And then you had strong chairman of the tax writing committees. Dan Rossi-Kinkowski had been there a long time. And even though he was a Democrat, he signed on to tax reform pretty early and really was a proponent.
Packwood
on the Senate side was a little different and didn't have the longevity that Rusty had, but he did sign on too. So you had those leaders agreeing to it, and magic really happened. But the magic really is, I'm convinced, in the low individual tax rate, a 28% tax rate. Actually, Treasury won. The first Treasury proposal was much higher, 33 or 34 or something like that.
I remember that.
And but the magic is the low rate, and that's the failure, I think, in David Camp's proposal. I was stunned. He comes up with a rate of 35%.
Right.
So no real rate reduction. It doesn't move people's minds.
So it doesn't excite them towards tax reform. He also had a goal of reducing. He hasn't really formally developed his corporate proposals as much as people would like, but he has a goal of reducing the overall corporate rate to match what our trading partners are paying tax at overseas. And one of the problems that I've always seen with that is that all of them have a VAT overseas to raise revenues, you know, through a national sales tax or a value-added tax. We don't. We have state and local taxes, but we don't have a national sales tax. And I don't see how we can reduce those corporate rates to match our trading partners unless we have a way of raising revenue to offset that rate reduction. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Is corporate tax reform really possible?
You know, I don't think corporate tax reform is possible without being part of an overall tax reform, individual and corporate. It just is, the system is too interrelated, and so much business, I don't have the exact figure, but I know it's north of 70% of business taxation now is at the individual level through partnerships, sole proprietorships,
right.
MLPs. Understandably, when you have, when you can do it, you can have pass-through entities. So I just don't see how you could do it separately, even though a lot of people seem to disagree with me on that. But you're really right on the value-added tax. The main thing of value-added tax is it takes pressure off the other taxes, both individual. You can have lower individual rates, and you can have lower corporate rates if you've got another major source of revenue.
But then you have a whole new enforcement mechanism.
And the problem with the VAT is it's going to be, it cannot help but be regressive. There are ways, with the lower individual, lower income individuals spend a higher percentage of their net worth on every year than do wealthier people, and so you're taxing them relatively more heavily. Now you can reduce that in some ways and come pretty close to it.
Exemptions
for food, right, necessities.
Right.
But still, the VAT rate, what is it? Maybe 15 or even
20%.
Almost 20% in
right.
some European countries. And in Simpson-Bowles, for example, well, let me say, in the tax reform studies of 86, that led up to 86, we considered a VAT. We had a panel on
consumption tax.
A consumption tax, which
right.
it is a consumption. And we had a booklet that we produced why we didn't do it. And Simpson-Bowles did about the same thing. They've said sort of politically, we just can't take on the fight of a new type of tax and not know how it's going to hurt. But I think your point is really valid if you're trying to compete on tax rate with countries that have another major source of revenue, it's very hard to do.
Do you think flat taxes are a possibility, or is that the regressivity still the same issue?
I think the flat tax is, I don't know why it hangs around like it does. I always say if you're in a restaurant, particularly a nice restaurant, and you're sitting down being served, you'll love the flat tax. If you're up standing up doing the serving, you're not going to love the flat tax. I mean, because if you have whatever rate you put, you eliminate taxes for everybody above that rate, and for the poor people who are below that rate, you don't. So it's just impossible. We did a study at Treasury when I was there, and the effect was just overwhelming. Taxes at the lower end go up and taxes at the upper end go down. So the simplicity of it seems to buy end up to a lot of people, but it's just unrealistic. They just need to spend 15 minutes reading about it, and they'd change their opinion.
Gotcha.
I also will say, though, people like to support something they don't fully understand. So many people support Simpson-Bowles. I don't think they've read part of what Simpson-Bowles would do, mainly tax capital gains as ordinary income.
Ordinary income, which is what we had during the Clinton years.
That's
and he
right.
balanced the budget.
That's right.
So there are some pros and there are some cons.
That's true.
And a lot of the tax planning we do revolves around the difference between capital gains and ordinary income.
I don't think we'll have tax reform until a new president comes in. We'll have it then only if that president gets behind it. But there's a lot of support for tax reform out there, a lot of unhappiness with the system. Obama just doesn't seem interested in it, and maybe the next president won't be.
You know, that was leading up to my last question, so it's a good segue. You know, the budget deficit is what concerns me most as a taxpayer, as a business person, as a lawyer, and it just keeps increasing. And you know, while we have sequestration to sort of harness the increase in deficits, I've never seen anything quite like it, where you know we're paying so much and out of our pockets to pay for interest on the national debt and paying for entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. How can we even talk about tax reform when we've got this giant elephant over our heads of budget deficits?
Well, let me say to me that may be one of the strongest arguments for tax reform, the deficit, because if you want to increase revenues, which we are doing, I mean, tax rates have gotten pretty high under Obama,
yep.
And this system, most of my economist friends would say this system cannot be the instrument we use to raise revenues. It's too inefficient. It's too damaging to the economy. So if you want to use that tool as a part of deficit reduction, I argue you really do need tax reform. The big fight that sort of is humorous to me almost, the big fight is if we do tax reform, the Republicans say it cannot raise additional revenues, and the Democrats say we're not signing on unless it does raise additional revenues. I've made this point at a lot of conferences, and I must be missing something because nobody agrees with me. But when you do tax reform, you broaden the base, and then you get a rate structure on that new rate to raise on that new base to raise the revenue you want to raise. So why don't we put off the argument whether it's going to raise revenue or not until after we do the reform and then decide the rate structure. I admit there's some political advantage to whatever that rate structure would be in good tax reform. It's going to be one heck of a lot lower than it is now.
Okay.
And so that, you'd have to say, won't be higher than 28 or 29% top marginal rate no matter what we do. So say that and then say, okay, then we'll have the political fight whether we want it to be total revenue equal to what it was before or more. And I would take that political fight and put it at the end of the game, not at the front of the game.
Interesting. I haven't heard it put that way.
No.
I like that approach.
I like it too, but I haven't convinced anybody.
Because politics always stand in front of logic and tax reform. And it's interesting because if we took that approach, we might be able to actually simplify an overly complex set of rules
right.
that are driving all different types of behaviors, home mortgage deductions.
That's really included. The point in fundamental tax. That was the whole point in developing the 86 Act. When we were doing that in 1984 at Treasury, our whole mantra was to take the tax system out of investment and business decisions.
Got it.
Just make it a neutral factor. And it seemed to me Republicans ought to buy that quicker than anybody because it's just another way government influences activity. We don't want that. We want a neutral tax system.
Well, we're talking
with... I haven't sold that either.
We're talking with Buck Chapadon, who is a senior advisor in the Washington, D.C. office of Brown Advisory and former assistant secretary of the Treasury for Tax Policy. And we're going to end this segment talking about tax reform. It's been a very interesting segment for me to listen to, and I hope it's been an interesting segment for the listeners. I think it has been. And we're going to segue into our next segment. We'll be talking about Buck's involvement with Brown Advisory and Brown Advisory as a wealth management advisory firm. So stay tuned for the next podcast. We'll be right back.